Welcome to Nothing of Champagne, a political podcast that would fail the 11+. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda, Steve Haynes.
Hello!
We're joined for the second time this series. We didn't scare him off after our conversation about Trump. It's Luke John Davis. Hey, LJ.
Hey.
When Theresa May unveiled her plan for grammar schools, she said she wanted to make Britain a great meritocracy. What's wrong with that? The only problem is, it's complete fiction. In this episode, we discuss why. The reason why meritocracy is fiction is because the term was first used by Michael Young. Young wrote Labour's Manifesto in 1945 and wrote The Rise of the Meritocracy 1870 to 2033. It's a dystopian novel in which Young basically argues meritocracy creates a new ruling elite, but with the added problem that the elite believe that they are there on merit and not by accident. We're going to start by talking about grammar schools. LJ, you wrote an article for Fabian Review on grammar schools in Birmingham.
It was a co-authored article with Councillor Bridget Jones, who's in
also,
Birmingham.
Also of this parish.
Yes, indeed.
It was
also for the Young Fabians magazine, Anticipations.
So apart from the two factual areas.
Yeah, apart from...
take two!
The central sort of conclusion that we reached was that grammar schools are the wrong answer to the right question. Not so much in terms of a meritocracy, but in terms of social mobility. Education is obviously the absolute soul and centre of social mobility, or at least of one strand of it. I mean, you still need to sort out what you're going to do with people who don't come through that system as winners, in inverted commas. The issue with grammar schools is that essentially what's happening is that they are becoming the preserve of people who can afford to pay for private tutors. So you're replacing a catchment area of people who can afford to buy houses in a well-off area with a catchment area of the people who can afford to hire expensive tutors. And there was a report in the Birmingham Mail that some people are spending around £5,000 on tutoring to get their kids through the 11+. Conversely to that, actually, one of the interesting things is that you are seeing grammar schools bringing in more pupils from a disadvantaged background. They are bringing in some of these poorer kids because they bring the pupil premium with them as a source of alternative funding. So what that means is that you're essentially squeezing out that, you know, anyone who is not so badly off that they bring pupil premium, but not well enough off to afford £5,000 worth of tutoring, is just got no chance at all. You're then sort of looking at the case of, well, what is the answer? And both myself and Bridget were saying that essentially what you're looking at is early years education. And there's also a distinction between early years education and early years childcare. Whereas, you know, a lot of the funding around at the moment is enough for childcare, but not enough for education, where you need someone who is more qualified, obviously, to educate the younger people rather than, or younger children, rather than just sort of make sure they don't, you know, eat the glue that's in the corner kind of thing, without trying to disparage people who do that at all.
We've all had lessons like that.
Yeah, I still eat the glue. So, you know, it's...
explains a lot.
It does. It's a much better way, because what you've got essentially in many cases is children starting school at 4 years old who are already behind their peers. You know, you do need to take that step in.
Statistics out in the week we're recording this about the inequalities within 5-year-old children, weren't there? I think that a widening inequality of, in terms of health outcomes, in terms of education outcomes, in terms of obesity, and in terms of education by 5. So even before then, there's already a big disparity.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you know, meritocracy is a myth in so many ways. But, you know, if you are wanting to give people the tools to better themselves, you need to start very early on.
I don't quite understand why we're talking about grammar schools. I mean, there's many, many studies talking about how they don't have impact on overall attainment and no impact on social mobility. My impression is it's kind of policy by anecdote.
It's policy by the good narrative, or a narrative that's very easy for everybody to understand, because at the end of the day, everybody knows someone who's very bright but has been let down in some way by the school system, or, you know, their friends, their family are convinced they probably could have gone to Oxford if they'd had the same kind of schooling as the people that do go to Oxford. Because of that, it's really easy for them to look around them and go, yeah, little Johnny over there could have totally gone on to do all that, and You know, if a grammar school would help him do that, why is that a bad thing? And it's just such an easy narrative which everybody can understand. I mean, you can show all the data that you like on the issue. I mean, you know, grammar schools, broadly speaking, do not work in terms of increasing overall social mobility. Yeah. They do, however, for the few people who are lucky to go there that do come from, like, the you know, poorer backgrounds, they do increase their life chances of those individuals, but they are few and far between.
History is written by the victors, almost, and as you say, you know, there are some who've come through the grammar schools and who did very well out of them. Theresa May spent a brief period at a grammar school during her youth. I know Andrew Neil has spoken of his time in a grammar school. The ones who went through and made it a success are now the ones who are writing policy, as we all do. They're looking at their own life experience to sort of say, and this is how I succeeded, and therefore it can be a model of success for other people. Mm-hmm. And what they don't see is the people who didn't go past the 11 plus, or, you know, yeah, didn't do so.
Yeah, and actually we talked a bit about that when we did a podcast last year on university education, in that a lot of the people who write policy now are those whose formative years were spent at university, and therefore maybe over-exaggerate the importance of university education, yeah, as opposed to putting money into early years. A really interesting chapter is in one of the David Kynaston books, who's, you know, I think Austerity Britain or Family Britain, I can't remember which one, but there's some really quite moving stories that he writes about of children who were at grammar schools in the 50s and 60s. The cultural disconnect that a lot of the people who won grammar school places had, because they fell between two stools, really. Mm. They were too working class to fit in a grammar school, but then were a bit too posh and la-di-da to then be in their working class communities. I mean, there's Ha Jun Chang ranked in one of his books about a documentary from Yorkshire in the 1980s. There's a retired miner who's talking to his son who went to grammar school and became a teacher. It sounds like something out of the Four Yorkshiremen sketch, but the miner basically says to his son that you're a class traitor because of what you've done going into that middle class.
Sort of, you saying that, actually, my grandfather was born in a little Welsh mining village, Aberchonan, and won a place at the county grammar school, and was there at 13, told grammar school boys, don't go down the pit, there is nothing here for you, and packed off to Birmingham to do an apprenticeship here because he was, you know, simply told that you don't fit in here anymore, there's nothing for you here. That's an interesting take on how you rise up in terms of social mobility, in that if you're breaking into that strata but you're still not part of it, in a sense, if you see what I mean. So you know, you're rising through the ranks in terms of, sort of, on paper, as it were, you know, you have that higher job or that influence on policy or what have you, but you're still not part of that elite culture. Is it really possible to break into that elite culture if you're talking about, you know, the perpetuation of that through things like networking or so on? You might have enough money to join the country club, but you're not part of, you know, you don't get in anyway, kind of thing. You know, to link it to the meritocracy idea, you know, is it actually possible to rise in such a class-based society as the United Kingdom?
Well, there's one of my favourite political quotes is, I think it was Alan Clark saying of Michael Heseltine that he's the kind of man who had to buy his own furniture. Because obviously the implication being that if you're of that sort of class, you ought to have furniture that you have inherited, yeah, probably since the 17th century. You probably stole it at Culloden or something.
Or at the very least, you're rich enough to be able to afford an interior designer to be able to just buy all of those things for you.
Yeah. Yeah. The point that you make in the article, which I think is and made just now, that it's the wrong thing for the educational system to be looking at, I think is absolutely right as well. There's so many issues with the education system at the moment. One of them is teacher recruitment, which is a huge problem.
Teacher retention as well.
Well, as a lapsed teacher, I'm still working in a school, but I know anecdotally from speaking to teaching colleagues that it's really, really hard to recruit at the moment. You've got many teachers who are just willing to work on long-term supply because you don't have to do the marking at the weekends, you don't have to do the planning in the evenings, you don't have to do the report writing, and that's becoming a more viable alternative just because the workload's too big. Mm. And funding's going to be a problem as well. We're going to see real terms funding cuts in education. And I think maybe where the grammars might even lead to a bigger problem, because it's quite possible that a bit like the free schools were under Gove, that these schools are given more resources and more time, which means that you've got less money then given to the other state-maintained schools.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think another sort of problem with teacher burnout, in a sense, is that more and more what you're doing is taking the teachers out of the classroom. You know, more and more of the teaching profession's job is not actually facing the kids. which is a problem. I mean, you know, it's long been a problem that I see it, that, you know, when you've got someone who is in a classroom and who does fantastically well teaching kids, the first thing you do to reward them is you take them out of the classroom. You know, the more you move up the sort of scale in teaching, you know, the less time you actually spend teaching children.
You can see that in terms of not many teachers want to be head teachers. There's not just a teacher recruitment crisis, there's a head teacher recruitment crisis because people don't want the stress. You can see that politically as well. So someone, say, like Alan Johnson, who I think everyone wishes... Well, he never went for Prime Minister, never went for Labour leader. If he had have stood for Labour leader, would probably have walked it. But
absolutely.
I think he felt he wasn't good enough to do the job. And it's like you were saying earlier about those kind of cultural barriers. It's a bit like the History Boys, where you can see that people from more disadvantaged backgrounds do like that cultural capital or that networking or lack that inner confidence that going to a private school gives you. Mm. You know, Alan Johnson doesn't have that inner confidence to say, I could go for it and I'm going to go for it. Whereas maybe then you end up with leaders who...
Boris Johnson.
Yeah, well, except people.
But David Cameron, I mean, David Cameron wanted to be leader because he was David Cameron and therefore he should be leader. I mean, you know, there wasn't really any kind of ideological driving force behind why he wanted to be leader, really. He didn't want to become leader in order to, you know, you compare him to, say, Margaret Thatcher, who the reason she wanted to become leader was to drive through her ideology and her beliefs. And as much as I completely disagree with them, that I recognise that that's what she wanted to do. Whereas, you know, David Cameron wanted to be leader because he was David Cameron and therefore he should be leader. And it's almost like the exact opposite of the Alan Johnson problem, in that, you know, you had someone who paid absolutely no attention to details and who will go down in history as one of the worst prime ministers we ever had. Certainly in his sort of 18-month, almost an interregnum, I suppose, after he became prime minister on his own rather than in the coalition. You know, to go back, you know, there may well be something in it. And you also see that in gender terms, that the sort of it's been written about in various places that women are more reticent to put themselves forward in many cases, and that's a problem. And, you know, I'm also sort of slightly aware that we're three blokes sat around talking about this as well, which
this is part of the white liberal middle class bubble.
Working class boy from Stetchford, I would take issue with the middle class part, but it's Sadiq Khan's point, middle class man, working class boy. But
talking about three white guys talking about things they don't understand, shall we talk about social mobility and meritocracy? It seems like as good a link as ever. I suppose it comes down to equality of opportunity, doesn't it? Is equality of opportunity merely enough?
It really does depend. Going straight for the technical nuance here, on what you mean by equality of opportunity and equality of outcome. If you mean equality of outcome in the sense of, you know, how often it gets portrayed, whether correctly or incorrectly, depending on who's actually talking about it, it ends up being, doesn't matter what you're doing, you will get the same amount of pay for it, or the same kind of resources available to you as everyone else. Then, you know, that's daft and it isn't feasible and it doesn't work. If you're talking about guaranteeing a certain minimum standard of living, guaranteeing, you know, that everybody gets a fair shot at the same time, you're combining kind of both elements of that in a way which will, you know, should in theory at least, deliver for individuals and ensure that everybody's got delivers for individuals in terms of their own personal progression, their own personal circumstance, but also ensures that you have that kind of much vaunted social mobility happening. Mm. What I would say is the issue with equality of outcome and where we're lacking at the moment is that when we talk about equality of opportunity, we always talk about social mobility and moving up. The reality is social mobility should also have people moving down.
Well, that's
where we kind of hit the bit of the issue with where we are at the moment. Mm-hmm. And you've talked about this briefly earlier on in the discussion, those kind of cultural differences between the different classes within the UK. And it's a similar kind of story wherever you go. The culture might change, but the difference between, you know, wealthy, middle class, working class, poor and on the breadline are always going to be there, just in different formats. I think if you're truly got a society which is guaranteeing people actual equality of opportunity, and they are, which then leads to a more equitable distribution of the outcome, which I think is what you probably need to aim for something that's realistic. You need to find a way, basically, where the basically all the people who've gone to Red Bricks because they're not quite bright enough to get into Oxbridge, and all their parents did go to Oxbridge, they don't end up in the same kind of positions. Yeah. And it's breaking down, as you said before, those cultural networks and that networking. Where the issue lies.
I'm not sure you can ever break down those networks. It's a case of almost setting up alternative networks. There is a certain concern in that equality of opportunity and equality of outcome very often gets misinterpreted as identical opportunities and identical outcome. There is more than one way of having a good life. Standard of life. You know, Eric Clapton got given a guitar at the age of 9. It seems to have worked out all right for Eric, you know? To certain of his teachers, I'm sure at some point somebody said to Eric Clapton, put down that guitar, you're never going to make a living out of doing that.
Yeah.
You know, get on to studying STEM subjects because that's where the jobs are, or, you know, learn your trade, become a plumber kind of thing. Meritocracy, as on a paper level, isn't a problem. You know, if everyone has the same opportunities and they rise to the level where they're good at, the problem is that you're never going to have a level playing field. You know, unless the state takes all of the children off parents as soon as they're born and gives them an identical schooling and an identical level of food and an identical level of this.
It's just Plato's Republic.
You have to strike a balance between that equality of opportunity and the equality of outcome, which at the moment is skewed towards an equality of opportunity. You have to almost take it back a step and work out why this myth of a meritocracy is so prevalent in society today. And I think it does go back to the sort of the rise in neoliberalism and this idea that we've moved from being a market economy to being a market society. And that means that the way we think of ourselves and as individuals within our society has moved from being citizen, which is an essentially collectivist identity, to being consumer, which is an entirely individualist one. Your consumer choices will therefore define your life chances and your life level, if you like. So, you know, if you make this consumer choice to get into debt now in order to get a degree, in order to get a better job, in order to pay off the debt later, and you will have a better standard of living, that is a consumer choice. Whereas if you say that, you know, when you go to university, it acts as a catalyst for the economy, and therefore it will benefit the individual, but it will also benefit society because they will pay higher taxes, they will add value to our economy as a whole, and therefore, you know, the university is an economic catalyst rather than something that's supposed to make money in and of its own right, that is an essentially more collectivist or more citizenship-based way of thinking about it. With the left, it seems to me, and I'm going to use the Labour Party as an example, the Labour Party seems to have moved away from being the party of the working class to being the party of the professional class. Mm-hmm. And professionals have no problem with status because they are quite happy to have differentiated in status because, you know, they're looking for promotion and so on. And they're quite comfortable in this individualised society. A big part of the division, the sort of perceived distancing of labour from the working class is that we've moved away from that. We talk about equality all the time. We stopped talking about solidarity. We've stopped with this idea of a common endeavour and of a common solution when so many of our problems are common, from environmentalism to everything else.
I think actually that's maybe one of the mistakes that New Labour made, is it was talking about consumer choice and competition in public services, when really I think about what Crosland was talking about socialism being, it was about collaborating and people collaborating, that's not a word, so he didn't talk about that. People working together. And as you say, it's probably a shift brought on by the neoliberalism that Blair and New Labour brought into a little bit.
Yeah. There is this argument that people make that in the last, or since the 1980s, the last 30, 40 years, the left won the social argument and the right won the economic argument. And I slightly disagree with that. I think the left won the social argument, but only within the terms of the debate set by the right, in that we did go into focusing on this idea of individualism and went away from that kind of founding creed of the Labour Party of our common endeavour.
The evidence seems to be that stronger welfare states and higher social mobility, so that kind of makes sense. But I think also, it's where schools funding cuts are really a problem. I mean, you talk about Eric Clapton and the guitar. Now, he was given a guitar at the age of 9. What worries me at the moment is there's an emphasis on the STEM subjects, as you say, and an emphasis on maths, and it means that lots of music programs are being cut in schools, drama programs are being cut in schools, sports programs, their funding is being cut as well. And so you can see that in actors. You know, you've got people like Dominic West and I think Tom Hiddleston are both old Etonians, aren't they? You've almost lost that meritocracy in the acting profession as well.
Creative professions. And sport.
And that could... with the
exception
teams.
Of football, but certainly in cricket and in rugby, that's definitely a problem. And if you look at the education systems that do very well, particularly somewhere like Finland, they do well across the board. They have a diverse system of education because they have a diverse range of subjects.
When you actually look at a number of the creative areas, music in particular, actually, and you dig into where a load of acts come from, a number of them do actually come from those from Finland and Scandinavian countries, which do those sorts of things. There are a number of like pop acts who break into the international charts from those things, and within certain genres of music, I'm thinking particularly of heavy metal, there's actually a preponderance of like just so many bands from that region and from those countries who manage to break out and actually become, you know, they're never going to be on the same scale as Iron Maiden or Guns N' Roses, but they are still very well known within their genre and very well and are able to make a lot make a living off of the music that they produce quite nicely.
I mean, Lordy won Eurovision, didn't
he? Yeah, exactly. You know. We've spent a lot of time kind of talking about, obviously, kind of like the need for kind of bringing back in that collectiveness, that solidarity, as you kind of termed it earlier. But I think one of the things that really does kind of come to the bottom of this, and this is where I think a lot of people kind of miss out when they're talking about equality of opportunity and to a certain extent therefore outcome, because the two are inherently linked in a lot of ways. And we've been doing it here. We've been talking about, oh yeah, Eric Clapton got given his guitar at 9 years old. Now, for Eric Clapton, that's brilliant, but it's him as an individual that's doing that, and it's creating the right opportunity for him to make the most of it, which then creates, you know, all of those effects. And I think one of the things that we are missing, and I do think this is very much the case within our education system, is that it's an assembly line, more so after an awful lot of Michael Gove's. But yeah, so I do think one of the things that you need to do as the baseline for all of that is actually there needs to be that focus on the individual, and it is them as an individual and their strengths and their talents and their interests which provides you with the baseline for all of this. And I think that is something which, especially when you start pitting almost the notion of the individual versus the collective, you end up with this notion of either you're either with the left with the notion of solidarity amongst all of the groups, or you're Margaret Thatcher and there is no such thing as society. Reality is a kind of a mesh between the two of them.
And it's the individual's contribution to the collective, and recognizing that an individual's contribution can be equal to but different from another individual's.
I think it's also providing the collective space for individuals to flourish. So if teachers feel they have too much workload, that means they can't put on the after-school football club or the after-school cricket club where you can get working-class kids playing that sport. It means if funding is cut, which means that music teachers can't be brought in, or drama classes can't be brought in, then kids miss out on those opportunities as well. I think the way to do that is in a properly collectively funded school system, and at the moment that's not happening.
I think the other thing to consider is the part the universities play in this, in that, you know, I mean, we had universities for 800 years before we had primary school provision for everyone, you know, and essentially our education system is a protracted series of, you know, nearly 15 years of university entrance exams, and the objective of the schooling system is to get you into university. And, you know, speaking of someone doing a PhD, it's worked really well for me, but not everybody learns by sitting and reading. Some people learn by listening. Some people learn by doing. There's a lot of different ways that people can do that. And by trying, you know, not just an assembly line. It's almost, you know, almost a sausage factory. You know, it's trying to take kids who are bright at various things and trying to force them to be bright at STEM subjects. You know, and well, perhaps they're a linguist, or perhaps they're, you know, perhaps they're a Eric Clapton kind of, you know, and you have to provide that individualism within it, but you also have to recognise that it is a way of contributing to the collective.
I think is it the Einstein quote about if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it's going to think it's a failure. What's the solution here?
If you're looking at the education system, the very first thing you need to do is focus on the teachers. There is no system of education you can put in place that is going to be better than the teachers that it has at its core. And if you've got, you know, high numbers of kids in a classroom and you're treating them all the same because you simply do not have time to get to know them well enough because you've got so much marking to do or so many reports to write and so on, that's the detriment of the pupils as well as to the teachers as well as to the society as a whole. Do you know many teachers, and I don't know any of them, that went into it to get rich? They went into it because they are dedicated to the idea of passing on knowledge, of helping children to grow. And if you give them the opportunity to do that, they will do it. The second thing is there needs to be alternatives to the current academic routes. The academic routes that were set up to essentially get classic scholars out. Whether you look at something like technical schools, you know, it certainly isn't a case of splitting them up at 11, but perhaps later on, you can split them off into that kind of area like they do in Germany.
The issue there is that for so long, the core assumption has been that vocational is worse. Vocational means you are stupid.
You failed
the 11 plus, therefore you're not good enough, you're not smart. Which, you know, as someone who's from Birmingham went to a comprehensive school because I failed the 11 plus, I'm still, you know, I'm a quite reasonably intelligent bloke. I've done very, very well out of my life.
Just leave him with his illusions, listen to his
You know, those tests aren't the be-all and end-all of anything, but they can, unfortunately for an awful lot of people, be the be-all and end-all, because the system that we have isn't set up to necessarily help them once they've been labelled as such.
It's also that it's not in touch with reality. My youngest brother is an apprentice at Jaguar Land Rover as a maintenance engineer, and once he graduates from his apprenticeship in September, now okay, it's because he's chosen up the horriblest and therefore best rewarded or best compensated shift pattern, but his basic salary will be over £60,000 a year. But still, people will sort of say, oh, he works in a car factory. Which is also a problem for the Labour Party. You know, we've got someone like that and we're trying to buy his votes with tax credits.
Shall we finish off just going back to what we talked about at the beginning about nursery schools and early years education? Mm-hmm. And there's, again, news out this week apparently that 1 in 10 state-maintained nurseries is in danger of closing because of funding cuts. I mean, we've talked a lot about what we think the approach should be. Is the reality that it's going to get worse before it gets better? Is it going to get better?
The problem is also that nursery schools that are maintained are still funded to about double the level of your sort of standard private or charity run nursery, which is the vast majority of the provision. So although, you know, saying we have to focus on nursery use is good, actually it also doesn't recognise the reality on the ground in that, you know, this funding needs to go to non-government funding positions as well. And it goes back to, you know, what I was saying about the difference between childcare and early education. Childcare is making sure that the child is happy and can sort of sit stay in a safe environment. Education is something very different. And, you know, there needs to be a far greater investment in early years education across that whole sector, not just into state-maintained nursery schools.
But on top of that, though, there's been some bits and pieces of research which shows throwing all of that, you can throw all the money in the world into the early education and make it actually education rather than childcare. But the reality is, if you're not following that up, where by the time they hit primary, by the time they get into secondary, it can slip away, and that's exactly what we found. Under the coalition, some extra cash was found for early years education. But what they found is they found that money went into it, and then the minute they went into primary school, that money wasn't necessarily there. Okay, there were some things like the pupil premium going in there as well, but, you know, without that kind of sustained focus throughout all of that child's, for lack of a better term, academic career, you know, the money you spend on early education can, in effect, be wasted. You cannot get people to where they need to be without early years education, but you need to make sure that it's followed through, which means you need a consistent educational experience and level of education throughout their entirety of their schooling.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please, if you could subscribe wherever you get them and leave a review, it does help people discover the show. If you want to follow us on Twitter, my handle is @paperbackwriter.
I'm @centreradical.
And I'm at LJDavies87, Davies with an E.
Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper, and our logo is designed by James Cram. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. Speak to you next week. Bye-bye. Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times. I can't speak anymore.